All right, hello everybody, and welcome back to Couch to Couch, Making Therapy Make Sense with Chuck LeBlanc. We have a special guest, Ashley Ho, today. She is a therapist from New Brunswick, and I will go ahead and let her introduce you and to her and let her walk you through what she does, and we'll take it from there.
Thanks, Chuck. Hi, I'm Ashley Ho. Chuck said I'm a therapist practicing in Fredericton, New Brunswick. I am predominantly practicing from a cognitive behavioral therapy lens and the different types of cognitive therapies that I've been trained in. So one of which is cognitive processing therapy, which is mostly for trauma and PTSD. And that's kind of my favorite thing to do. So
awesome. Well, welcome to the show. So CPT, CBT, all of the things that start with C, PTSD and trauma. Awesome.
Yeah. Well,
so I'm not that familiar with CPT. So I know a little bit about CBT, and I know there's some, I think in the last episode with I interviewed Ian Heft, I know you know Ian, and we talked about, a little bit about dialectical behavioral therapy, so DBT. And all I know from CPT is that there's like elements in there which are very similar to DBT, such as like Socratic questioning and things like that. So walk me through what is CPT?
Yeah, so all the different subdivisions of cognitive behavioral therapy like DBT and CBT are kind of built on the idea that our thoughts and our feelings and our behaviors are all kind of interconnected. So a feeling can impact the way you think or intensify it, and then that generates intensifying thoughts, which impacts behaviors. And basically the idea of cognitive behavioral therapy is that if you start intervening, especially at the kind of level of thinking, that you can start changing that process of what you're thinking, feeling, and how you're behaving. So cognitive processing therapy is specifically for trauma, and it is based on the idea that if you start addressing how a person thinks about the various traumas that they've experienced, that you can kind of de-intensify or hopefully eliminate symptoms of PTSD over time, because it isn't necessarily how a person reacts to a trauma in the first place that causes PTSD or that initial experience. It's how they begin making sense of how and why the trauma actually happened to them.
Oh, interesting. Can you tell me more about that? I didn't know that. I didn't think of that. I always look at everything on a biological perspective and then work my way out. But that's an interesting take on PTSD.
Yeah. So the premise of cognitive processing therapy is basically that humans grow up with this propensity to like make sense of information and to organize it. One of the most early lessons we learn as people growing up is the just world myth. So children, when let's say they're being potty trained, as an example, they learn that they get a treat when they use the potty, and then they get reprimanded or another negative consequence, like even a treat is withheld if they have an accident and fail to use the potty. So the just world myth is kind of good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. So when a trauma happens, we need naturally to make sense of why it happened, partly to organize it as an information to see if, you know, well, information is power. We want to know if that trauma is likely to happen to us again. So we have to figure out ways to make sure that it doesn't happen to us again. And we just start organizing and analyzing information about it. So in the just world myth idea, if bad things happen to bad people, then a person experiences a trauma. And to make sense of that and to kind of organize information in the just world myth, they tell themselves different things like, I am bad. And that's kind of where PTSD breeds, is how people start understanding why a trauma occurred, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense because I guess it's an ideology problem. I guess just because you grow up building a framework of how the world works, and how the world works is good people get good things happen, bad things happen to bad people, and then a bad thing happens to you. And then the only way to understand that, based on the ideological framework you were born into, the just world myth, would be to suggest, well, I must be a bad person somehow. It must be my fault. I must have deserved this, and that sort of thing, which is distorted. As therapists, we know that's distorted, but it can be difficult when you're in it and you don't have any other way to organize your ideology, your world, your framework.
That's exactly it. So, growing up, when we're learning behaviors like toilet training, we can use black and white thinking, like good and bad. But as we get older, our thinking becomes more complicated and how we see the world, a gray area starts to exist. But for some reason, whenever trauma happens, and it's probably just that survival instinct, we revert back to the black and white thinking. So basically, if I were to paint CBT with a broad, singular, broad brush stroke, I would say that it's helping people who are stuck in the black white thinking of the just world myth to kind of think more middle ground and more so in a gray area about why the trauma happened. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense because if I was to overlay this with my biological understanding, it would be that when you're growing up, the listeners hear me talk about the amygdala so much they're probably sick of it at this point, but we'll go one more time. So when you're growing up, we all know that the amygdala, part of what it does is survival instincts, and it holds the reactions to feelings, implicit memory, so that it can react, right? And just to keep you alive, that's its job. So all it cares about is keeping you alive, keeping you safe. And so when you're younger, I guess you're learning through this black and white thinking, through this ideological framework, you're learning what safe looks like and how to keep yourself safe. So these controlling mechanisms to make sure you stay in this framework. And then when you get jarred, like a trauma happens, a snapshot of that is taking place because you grew up like that. It's your habits when you're growing up. So if you get, if you're in a traumatic situation in your 20s, years after you've gone through puberty, everything's all solidified, you're going to revert back to being like 8, 9, or 5 whenever you learn the black and white thinking, because that's the point where you got that safety mechanism. So it's never, it's never about your brain trying to trip you or screw you up. It's about this was the safest at the time, we're doing that.
The added, it's like an adaptive process that, sometimes get out of whack for sure. And that's exactly it. The snapshot, as you said, it's kind of like cognitive distance between, trying to make sense of why something happened, and it reverts back to that thinking style. We see a big part of trauma, or being what maintains trauma, is disassociation. And there are a lot of thinking styles and behaviors that kind of facilitate disassociation and make the PTSD keep going on, which is really well aligned with that fight or flight or faint system. I see a lot of fainting behaviors where people are kind of like self-numbing in order to avoid feelings that naturally occur because of a trauma and that are supposed to occur because of a trauma, like sadness and grief and anger. We see a lot of binge drinking or binge eating, even unsafe sex practices, impulsivity, spending, things like that, that would surprise you. And at the root of that is really the fight or flight or faint responses, kind of just your body's way of really wanting to tolerate or self-medicate the stress.
Attempt to create safety around it in the only way it knows how.
Exactly. Well
neat.
Put.
Neat. Okay, well, so how does it work? How do you Yeah, because I'm not familiar with CPT, so what's the process? Like, walk me through how this works.
Yeah, so it's designed in its like pure form to be completed in like 12 sessions for an average client, but there's room to kind of expand on that if needed, and some clients go through the process quicker. So basically what happens is client therapist meet, the client kind of, or the therapist gets the client to give quote unquote a storybook version of what the trauma happened. So just kind of like an idea, a summary of what it is that happened. The client will write a trauma impact statement. So the trauma impact statement, it has to be at least one page, and they go into as much detail as they can. And that really helps, I think, to fight dissociation or at least highlight where dissociation exists within that written statement of how the trauma has impacted them in terms of these five different constructs, one of which is self-esteem. And safety, power and control, trust, and intimacy, and how these constructs impact them in terms of how they relate to themselves, like their ability to be self-intimate and comfortable with themselves and intimate with other people, how they perceive their level of power and control to be themselves versus power struggles or power they perceive other people or the world to have, and so on. How well you can trust yourself, how well you can trust other people. Yeah, and so on. So how those five constructs pertain to self and others. And from there, what we begin to do is flush out really concise statements while the client reads the trauma impact statement to the therapist that kind of perpetuate the trauma. So things like, for example, if there were a shooting that the client experienced and it is traumatizing them, they might be saying, John Doe might have lived or would have lived if I were able to push them out of the way, that sort of thing. So then that kind of like survivor's guilt and PTSD is in part maintained by that belief that it was their fault. Different stack points are either fall into the category of self-assimilated. So we talked about that earlier. And it kind of pertains to self-blame. So explaining the trauma as being fault of them. And then there are over-accommodated stack points where people kind of solve the just world myth by finding blame in other people or the world, if that makes sense, or finding an explanation in other people in the world, like the world's super unsafe, or a rape victim might say all men are bad.
Trying to compensate to kind of stay within the framework while making sense of the chaos that they experienced.
Yeah, exactly. To organize it. That's perfectly super well put.
Yeah, what do they call that? Is it compensated? There's a word for that.
So
I forget. We'll say compensated.
Yeah, you'll have to add it at the end. That'll be the caption of the talk. Yeah, so once those kind of stuck points are identified, those different dysfunctional thinking or concise thoughts are identified that are keeping people in trauma, basically step by step, go through the process of challenging those thoughts, collecting evidence for and against them in different ways. And then once the client has collected, and it has to be the client who's collecting evidence for and against these different stuck points, and then they're able to kind of generate a new thought, basically, to replace it. So that sort of challenging process, it isn't just about the specific stuck point. It's kind of just re-challenging your thinking style, and that generalizes to how you kind of see the world or challenge your thoughts moving forward. So it creates a healthier way of, or more rational way of looking at the world, if that makes sense. We use the PCL5, so the post-traumatic stress disorder checklist, to kind of, we chart their baseline scores to see how many symptoms they're showing or how intense their symptoms are from the onset of therapy. And then we retest each week and kind of just chart their scores and see if the post-traumatic stress disorder is going down over time as it should.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's a scale to kind of watch as this goes.
Yeah, exactly.
So how often would you do that over the 12 sessions as far as the PSL-5 is?
Weekly. So some clients, though, if you know they can accommodate it, I will see twice a week. So.
That's amazing. I often thought about twice a week sessions and how that will work. I have a few clients that we do twice a week. It's called for. It's rare, but it does happen. So with CPT, is that like a average that happens often?
No, not at all. So it would be specifically within CPT and then some therapies like DBT. With CBT, you kind of have the advantage to do that, because I feel like a big concern with seeing a client twice a week is over dependency onto the therapist, which is not good. But within a CPT framework, I think especially where it's so much about challenging and you're training the client basically to challenge their own thoughts, where it's said that a goal of CPT is challenging them or training them to be their own therapist. So that dependency or enmeshment, I think it's facilitated a lot less. So I think within CPT it can be appropriate, but for somebody who's doing like emotional focus therapy or something like that, where it's like, I feel like there's more potential for those lines to be blurred and dependency to be created. Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, depending on what form of therapy you're talking about, countertransference and transference situations are wildly important. You know, for some modalities, they get you to run away from them just because there's certain things that can come up that are just not good. But you have to, if you're a good therapist, you shouldn't run into those situations in the first place. But they're very important to bring into the room. You know, there's one, I forget the name of it now, but one thing that can happen is, especially well with trauma, is the reparenting situation, right? So you're dealing with someone who's had a rough childhood and the abuse was purely based on being dismissed by parents who were unavailable because let's say that they couldn't handle their own shit, basically. So let's say you got two anxious parents who can't handle themselves. So how the hell are they going to handle a child? So they're constantly dismissed. And because the parents are so out of whack with reality, the child has to become the parent. So not only are they dismissed as children, so they have to raise themselves, but they also have to take the parenting role and keep their parents safe, right? So the amount of guilt and shame that's used to keep the child in check, which then, as we talked about earlier with the building an ideology, right, and the habits, then gets brought in to your amygdala. So that guilt and shame are then used by you to keep you in check. What ends up happening is you live a life without a parent, basically. So in therapy, what can sometimes happen is you become, the therapist becomes the parent. So it's a reparenting situation. And that is a funny line to walk, right? Because that's an awkward line to walk, and you have to be damn careful with that. But you have to be very aware of the transference that's going on to figure out that that's what's happening. Those are the threads that you pull on in therapy to make sure that everyone's aware of it. Because what you're learning to do, basically, when you're playing that dance, what you're trying to do is to get them to basically dethrone guilt and shame as their ways of keeping themselves in check and get them to parent themselves, which essentially means get them to accept themselves so that they don't end up dismissing it. But for a lot of the clients in these situations, they've never been parented and they've never been accepted, so they don't even know what it's like. And so part of walking that line in emotional focused therapy or person-centered therapy, which is a lot of what I do, to toe that line, you have to be very careful, because what you're doing is you're helping them build a concept that they can then figure out. First of all, they have to figure out what the concept is, what does it feel like, how does it work, and then they have to figure out, do I like this? First of all, do I even want this? What pieces of it do I want? What pieces of it do I not want? What are we building here? But in order to do that, they have to experience it. So part of how I am in therapy is I'm super, well, a lot like I am in life, super open and very direct, so that the client doesn't have to guess what I'm thinking ever. They don't have to get in that mode of like being judged. Instead, I'm just very direct and saying things that are right in my head. And the idea is that they're building this concept of parenting themselves and avoiding dismissing themselves by listening to their voice. But you're right, it's a careful line. It's a very careful line that you have to walk, because dependency can breed from that if you're not watching.
Yeah.
So it can be difficult to navigate when that repair shows, or that rupture shows up.
Yeah, and I think that for sure it's kind of, even in like every therapy, it is sort of like reparenting yourself, because it's learning how to look at yourself at the basis, even of CPT, with like an unconditional positive regard that you know, you have worth and stuff regardless of what or why anything happened. A really lovely quote I absolutely love about complicated PTSD, so that developmental trauma, by Judith Herman. And I don't want to butcher it, but it's basically that healing can only happen within the process of a relationship, that it can't happen out of a relationship. And I think that's kind of like really well aligned with what you just said about reparenting, because parents basically teach kids how to look at themselves, how to look at other people, and how to look at the world and how to treat themselves and stuff. And that is kind of more or less the role that the therapist does adopt. I think that there's definitely, with every good therapist, more boundaries than there would be between a parent and a child.
Definitely.
And the idea is basically just to teach kids how to human and teach clients how to be their own therapist. So it's in a lot of ways very, very, very similar.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think that, I mean, Judith Herman was like a god to trauma therapists. Like, I remember reading her book in the trauma course and several times since then. Mm-hmm. And just feel, you know, you feel overwhelmed when you read it because you're like, this, she got it. Like, she figured it out. You know?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, a lot of what informs me coming into this mm-hmm. from my background before I even started as a therapist was that human beings were social animals.
Exactly.
We are relationship first. And mm-hmm. that's why I find it so interesting with trauma specifically, or mm-hmm. addictions, which is most of the time both. But how do I put it? It really is all about the relationship. And what's neat, so when healing, and I'm going to ask you this question after, but when healing starts to happen, I do notice it's when the client starts to figure out that the ways they're protecting themselves, mm-hmm. no matter how seemingly maladaptive, mm-hmm. the brain, the amygdala, who they are, is trying to help. You're never deliberately trying to sabotage, like self-sabotage. I hate that word because it's never self-sabotage. You're never trying to screw up your life. You're never trying exactly. to hurt yourself. Mm-hmm. All of your processes are trying to keep you safe and alive, right? The difference is, when your amygdala is doing it, it only cares about present danger, whether mm-hmm. that's a memory flash or a situation right in front of you, but not concerned about long-term consequences because that's not its job. That's your exactly. prefrontal cortex's job, right?
Yes.
And so when you end up with, you know, an addiction situation with alcoholism, mm-hmm. well, of course you reach for the bottle if that was the only, mm-hmm. only way you could figure out how to numb the pain. If it's all you had from this dangerous situation.
Yeah.
In that moment, it helped.
Yeah, that's super well. We know it's maladaptive
because of long-term consequences, right? We know that later on, that's going to cause a problem. But, yeah. right?
Yeah, and that's the thing is when you are reliving trauma and you're stuck in the PTSD cycle, your amygdala and, you know, your hindbrain is kind of what's steering the ship. Mm-hmm. When you're feeling triggered, the prefrontal cortex, it takes a backseat to the amygdala. So all of that, those processes for drinking and stuff like that and self-medicating and learning how to survive within the moment and feel good within the moment, and those start to make a lot of sense. So I totally agree with what you're saying, that it's not a self-sabotage thing. It's self-medicating. Humans have the propensity, like Judith Herman always said, to be healing and want to heal. Yeah.
So I guess the beginning points of therapy is rebuilding that relationship with yourself and all the parts of you, but it's the relationship that matters. And then building it outwards. So you can do it in the vulnerable space of being with a therapist, because they're there for you 1 hour a week or 2 hours a week or whatever the setup is with your therapist, but they're there just for you. To be open, honest, and non-judgmental, so you can learn what that even means and how to build a relationship in the first place. And then branch out, building relationships outside of the therapy room in a safe concept that propels you forward and doesn't hold you down.
Exactly. And it's really cool because in a lot of ways, the therapist's job does mimic that of a parent, as you said. But how you just framed that, where you're meeting with a therapist like once a week or X number of times per week, and the therapist has all of your attention. It's like concentrated parenting almost, where like all of the kind of the main teaching parts are kind of put, you know.
All in one shot, kind of like drinking concentrated orange juice instead of watering it down.
Yeah, espresso.
Yes, fair enough. I should have gone the espresso route.
Yeah, espresso parenting.
Awesome. So I know we got on the parenting route and we started with being dismissed. So how does, when it comes to trauma and or PTSD, where does, you know, the childhood experience of being dismissed fit in? Do you see that a lot?
Absolutely. I would actually say that I see more developmental trauma than I do singular traumas like rape, or being involved in like a murder or crime and stuff. It's mostly developmental trauma that I'm seeing. And complex trauma, as Judith Herman describes, but it's not, I don't believe, in the DSM yet.
Maybe we should define
It
those. Yeah, I haven't talked about this before on the podcast, so define those for me.
So complex trauma is basically trauma that happens over and over again. It's not just something that happens and it's one or done, and then you begin the process of trying to heal from it. It is things like invalidation, verbal abuse, psychological abuse during, like, especially we see it during developmental years. So developmental trauma is a part of that. And it happens over and over again. So it's kind of like interwoven into people's self-concepts and way of being, not just at one point of their life, but over and over and over again. So it's complicated, hence complex drama.
So it's repeated, right? Because it's repeated over time, but the situations that are repeated are happening right in front of you over and over again. So it's re-traumatizing in new scenarios just with the same theme.
Yeah, we could say that. I mean, I'm sure there are situations where it's like different, but for example, like somebody who, and I don't want to get into kind of the weeds or a danger zone of making generalizations, but let's say a person who, well, we know Judith Herman has the term re-traumatization, and she talks about how somebody who is sexually assaulted will have an increased likelihood of being sexually assaulted again or introduce themselves to new traumas because they're in that, survival mode, fight or flight. So they're making decisions, riskier decisions, to kind of like cope with the trauma and try to heal themselves. So like trying to get drugs, for example, to self-medicate, they might put themselves in the situation of going to a really non-advisable party, we'll say, and they can be re-traumatized sexually, but like also introduce themselves to new traumas. And that's not, again, in any way like pointing blame. It's just how people heal, and then the likelihood of or probability of being exposed to more re-traumatizing factors. So within a family unit, like where a child is experiencing abuse, the kids might be constantly invalidated over and over again. And I think that is what you mean by themes. But then also, if the family, let's say, why is the family prone to that? Were they raised poorly themselves? Is there like bad socioeconomic or lower socioeconomic factors at play that might expose them to other things that are traumatizing and stuff? So it's like they can experience a whole bunch of different types of trauma or different themes of trauma because there's an underlying reason or an umbrella reason that invalidation is occurring that will also cause other themes of trauma. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. Yeah, that makes it a lot more clear. So, and so when it comes to being dismissed, how with developmental trauma like that, invalidation, dismissal, how does that often show up in therapy?
Yeah, for sure. So that's a really good question. And I think a lot of it When I see somebody who's been chronically invalidated and almost made fun of during their formative years, you see a lot of those assimilated stuck points where it's dysfunctional thinking that's directed towards the self. So I'm stupid. I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm not worth it. They're trying to rectify that sense of cognitive dissonance of good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people by blaming it inward instead of outward, I find. Most commonly, I have seen people who have been invalidated who are on the other end of the spectrum where it's like they're blaming the world and everybody's bad and everybody's mean. But really, I see in developmental trauma more so the assimilated stuck points.
Gotcha. And so when it comes to that, what is the first step of treating them? So with CPT, I'm gonna show that I was listening to see if I understand. So make sure you correct me because this is so super new.
Sure.
So I guess in the beginning points of therapy, it's about exploring those complicated pieces of trauma so you can understand the themes of how they were invalidated and also what they were telling themselves with those five pieces, right? Self-esteem. I know self-esteem, intimacy, there's power dynamics at play. What was the other two? Intimacy with themselves. I think I'm missing one.
Yeah, so there's esteem, power and control, trust, then safety. And did I say intimacy?
Yeah, intimacy with the self and others, I think.
Yeah, intimacy, esteem, power and control, trust and safety.
Okay. And I think the one that I'm most interested in, so for the last little bit, I'd like to focus on that. Is the power and control piece? Because you said something in the beginning of the talk, which I thought was really brilliant. I hadn't thought of this in terms of cognitive behavioral therapy before, but where it was like power and control of their self. So I assume that you meant self-concept with that, and then power and control of how they relate to others. Is that how that works?
Yeah, so it can happen, I guess, in different ways, but I see it most commonly as a power struggle. And if someone were invalidated a lot, especially growing up, like you, parents are basically supposed to promote their kids' autonomy and teach them how to be autonomous people. That's like job number one, how to take care of yourself. And when you have an invalidating parent, which I do see, the authoritative parent, like, no, this isn't how you tie your shoes. This isn't how you cross the street. This isn't how you do it. You do it my way. And every time the kid is trying to do something, the parent kind of hijacks it, the process of them learning how to be autonomous and learning how to do these different things and being confident in it and their ability to solve a problem. And they make them feel like they can't do it right, basically. So in terms of power control and how invalidation might play into that with complex or developmental trauma, kids either, they might become totally helpless and be like, I can't do anything growing up, and it's that kind of idea of learned helplessness. There's no winning, so why try? But then there might also be people who grow up and they start thinking that authority is all bad, and they overaccommodate kind of the belief like police are bad, parents are bad, and it might look like a ruptured relationship where the child is grows up and it is almost done with the parent and just cuts them out of their life and hates them because of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's hard. That's hard to hear and hard to deal with. And I guess that would come up a lot with even with situations of like childhood bullying. Sustained bullying over time is going to erode the pieces of what the parents are teaching you, regardless if they're teaching you self-autonomy or not.
Absolutely.
I think of my own background as I was severely bullied from like an early childhood age all the way up until I was about 17, 18. And that's the entire time you're supposed to learn how to belong. You're supposed to learn what self-concept is, self-esteem, what you are to other people. And that leaves you feeling completely invalidated everywhere you go. And that's where like the monster of imposter syndrome develops from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I can definitely see that. And it takes a lot of work to gain that power back, to gain enough experiences in life, and then be able to digest those experiences to create the right story where you're like, wait a minute, you know, I have two master's degrees and an undergrad, but I failed high school. Exactly. It's like, well, which one of those shows where my intelligence lies, right?
Yeah.
Well, I actually
can. Hey, you say you're not a cognitive therapist, Chuck, but you really just went through the process of doing CPT on yourself.
Well, I had a good good teacher. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, because on one hand, you're saying all of these things happened to you that invalidated you and made you question your self-worth. But then you're like taking stock of all the things that kind of debunk that. And that's really what the process would look like for somebody who is trying to reassert themselves and regain that power control back, is how is that wrong? And kind of looking at their life practically. So that's, in a nutshell, I guess what it is. But also, I do want to say that I was also really bullied growing up. So I think that you should probably run a poll on how many of us therapists were.
Yes.
Your common theme, survivors of bullying.
Yeah, it's definitely something that comes up a lot over the podcast and the conversations that I have. I mean, bullying seems to be an inescapable factor of youth, which is really too bad because it's incredibly traumatic and it's a long lasting. I remember seeing, I forget when this was, early on in my university career, somebody had posted a YouTube video of a teacher trying to teach the effects of bullying, and they used a piece of paper.
Okay.
And they said, every time somebody's bullied, you like crinkle up the piece of paper, and you can flatten that piece of paper all you want, but the crinkles are still there. And now looking back on it 20 years later or 17 years later, I'm thinking that is a really good analogy for trauma.
Mm-hmm. It definitely is. Mm-hmm. But when you flatten out that paper, just because it has wrinkles in it still, and those things are kind of like everlasting or pervasive, it doesn't mean that the paper is less good or less effective at being paper. It just has a few lines in it.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, once the process of therapy is done, you end up becoming incredibly adaptive. That's, I guess, the amazing other side of all of this is, you know, they talk about post-traumatic growth and things like that. It really has to do with switching the script from post-traumatic stress to growth, but also from maladaptive to adaptive, right? And, you know, in my own life, I can see, and it happens to clients all the time, that once you get to the other side of it, there's almost the situations that I've encountered in my 30s, let's say.
Yeah.
Things that in my early 20s or my teenage years would have like left me flat on my ass are just situations to, I encounter them and they're like, well, okay, we have to deal with this now. Because I've been through some things, I've grown from them, and now my strengths, my toolbox is a lot more adaptive than it was before.
Yeah, exactly. And I believe that post-traumatic growth is possible because, you know, we put in the time and we learn those tools and things. Mm-hmm. And the reason I emphasize that is because I've heard a lot of talk about post-traumatic growth being thrown around as a buzzword in different professions, specific to professions. I'm not going to call anyone out here. And it's almost like going in with that superior virtue of the oppressed thing, where people use that as almost an insult. Like, oh, you shouldn't experience PTSD, some people experience post-traumatic growth instead. But it's like, you know, post-traumatic stress happens and then you resolve it and then there's the growth from my perspective, whereas people in certain professions are trying to make it look like post-traumatic growth is there, that better people almost experience
that's right,
that.
That's right.
Does that make sense?
It does, and I have to be so damn careful with that because it's a complete misunderstanding of the process. Complete misunderstanding.
It's super reductive. Absolutely.
Yeah. Reductive. Yes. That's exactly right. And damaging. Damaging as hell.
Absolutely. As if you haven't been traumatized enough to categorize your trauma in a way that kind of like perpetuates more self-blame.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry, you're not good enough to grow.
Yeah, exactly.
Idiots.
Yeah.
This is not how it works at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. Good. Well, that's us. That was fantastic. Thanks for walking me through CPT. I feel far more informed about that now. And walk me through the processes and really getting a good handle on complex trauma. That's the first deep, in-depth conversation we've had on the podcast when it came to that. And I think it's long overdue.
Awesome. Thank you for having me. It was lots of fun. Good to talk to you as always, Tuck. You're a well-articulated and really approachable man. I like you lots.
Thank you very much. And before I let you go, I know that you're working in Fredericton at the moment, out of comfort counseling?
No, that's my friend, Monica Smythe. She has comfort counseling.
Monica, whoops.
Yeah, no. So I'm through conscious counseling and wellness. And that is owned and operated by the absolutely most lovely woman I've ever met, Sarah Mackey. Just a phenomenal lady. So there's her, her sister, who's an occupational therapist, Cindy Mackey, and she works with kids. And then we have another clinician, Anna Larmer, and myself. Yeah, so a small but super passionate team. And trauma and eating disorders are kind of where most of our specialty lies.
Fantastic. And before I let you go, let us know where to find you. So I know you have you and Conscious Counseling have a pretty stellar Instagram platform. Let us know where we can find you.
Yeah. So Conscious Counseling and Wellness, their page is, or Instagram tag is Conscious Counseling and then the underscore wellness. Myself, I am Ashley underscore Ho underscore psychotherapy. And then we have two other clinicians too. You can find their taglines. I don't know off hand, but right on the Conscious Counseling and Wellness Instagram homepage. So yeah.
Awesome.
Check us out.
We will, and we'll make sure this, so this will all be on the recording so everybody can find you, get to the Instagram. What do they call that? Perfect. Add you or follow? Follow, that's what it is.
Follow, yeah.
My age accidentally showed there. Yeah, we'll set it up. So it was great talking to you as always, and we will see you next time.
Awesome. Thank you, Chuck.